Welcome to Needs No Introduction, fresh ideas from speakers of note. I'm Leif Larson. On the eve of Buy Nothing Day, it might seem strange to hear this message. Anti-consumerism can be used to sell us things. But that's exactly the message that Dr. Joseph Heath, co-author of The Rebel Cell and a professor of philosophy at the University of Toronto, sent in Winnipeg this week. In place of anti-consumerism, Heath makes several recommendations about how we can become better consumers, both as individuals and as a society. I had the chance to speak to Dr. Heath by phone just before his presentation. We talked about consumerism, activism under a majority government, and the Occupy movement. Here's what he had to say.
Okay, I guess my first question would be, and it came from an interview you did with Uptown Magazine earlier this month, where you argued that Canada's Occupy movement was protesting against a financial system that isn't broken.
Right.
In that interview, you asked, you know, why not occupy Fort McMurray? Consider that there are so many global campaigns opposed to the tar sands, do you think that Occupy should hitch its wagon to a movement that's already going on, or do you think they really need to strike out and find somewhere new?
Yeah, well, what I was trying to articulate in those interviews, and it's tough, you know, with print media, because often you get two sentences of what you said in a half hour winds up making it into print. But I was sort of trying to draw a distinction between the Occupy movement in the United States and in Canada. And I was trying to argue that the Occupy movement in the United States is sort of long overdue and is, you know, a good thing in general. But that in Canada, I sort of felt that it's a little bit misdirected in the sense that in many ways it's once you occupy Wall Street, everybody wants to occupy everything. But in many ways, I found that it didn't sort of crystallize around distinctively Canadian issues. So like, I can understand why if you're an American, there's lots of things to be really frustrated about. And Wall Street is kind of the epicenter of a lot of things that are gone wrong in American society. But I don't actually think that right now, say, Bay Street in Toronto is the epicenter of a lot of bad things happening in Canadian society. So I was just sort of unhappy about the way in which the Occupy movement wasn't sort of responding to specifically Canadian concerns.
Right, and I know that's been one big criticism of Canada's Occupy movement, that whereas the American Occupy movement seems to really focus on the financial system, Canada's Occupy movement doesn't seem to have the same kind of focus.
Yeah.
If you had to give advice to the Occupy movement, as hard as that would be considering how spread out they are, what piece of advice would you give them to try to get that focus? Where do you think they should be focusing their efforts?
Well, I mean, I don't want to be thinking sort of small scale, but it is important to recognize that there is a tendency in Canada to imagine that all of the problems that the United States has, either we must have them as well, or it's just a matter of time before we have them. And in fact, that's often not the case. So if you look at the story on inequality, for example, the United States has had this dramatic increase in inequality. The increase in inequality in Canada has been far less dramatic. So, for example, like the level of inequality of income in Canada is less than in France. It's far less than in Great Britain. I mean, you know, we have like, you know, comfortable European levels of inequality, and that trend hasn't really changed in the last 30 years. So, like, we're doing things that are different on the front of inequality than what's going on in the States. So I do think that it's a mistake to necessarily get exercised about exactly the same problems. Simply because Canada really, like, it's important to recognize when we are doing things right and to then try to be positive about the things that we're doing right in this country. So I think, this is kind of small potatoes, but for example, the crime bill that's in Parliament right now is, I think, extremely reactionary and obnoxious in a lot of different ways. It would be nice to see greater mobilization around that. And then obviously, like, the big one is the tar sands and what's going on with the environment and with oil and so forth. I mean, Canada's basically running around the world right now acting like Saudi Arabia when it comes to climate change. So those are kind of big issues where Canada's doing something that's actually quite obnoxious. And it'd be nicer to see mobilization around those kinds of issues.
So in terms of mobilization, I mean, we have the first majority government we've had in this country for, I think, 6 or 7 years. You know, and I think activists are kind of scratching their heads saying, you know, how can we be effective against a majority government?
Yeah, no, I agree. And that's actually one of the significant differences between Canada and the United States, which is that in the United States, the Occupy movement serves this incredibly useful role of reclaiming some of the kind of territory in the media and in the public consciousness from the right, you know, because what's happened in the States is that you've had a Democratic president and until recently a Democratic Congress who have been unable to get their agenda passed, right? And so when the big Reform Act, the Dodd-Frank bill over financial regulation was being debated, the left in the United States was really just sitting on their hands. Like, there was, you know, the airwaves were completely dominated by Tea Party, and then the financial industry spent like well over $1 billion lobbying against that bill, and the left was just completely absent in that whole discussion. So obviously it's incredibly useful for the left to be out there, making some headlines, emboldening politicians, mobilizing people, and so forth. That's extremely useful because in the United States, you've got a political system where you actually have a Democratic president who's unable to get things done. And so I think the Occupy people in New York can plausibly claim to be speaking for the 99%. In Canada, obviously, it's a little bit different because Canadians just elected a majority conservative government, and it seems that every time we have another election, the vote share of the conservatives go up. And so obviously sparking a new election or that sort of thing is not, you can see how people could be a little dispirited by the situation. Basically, nothing's going to happen on a progressive front for the next 4 years. So we just have to kind of, you know, bide our time. But, you know, that, you know, so I think that, you know, that there's reason to be more pessimistic about what's likely to be the upshot of popular protest in Canada. There's not so much that can be done. I mean, there are various ways in which you can intimidate sitting governments and even majority governments so that you can get them to moderate their positions. But, you know, it's difficult to see how anything extraordinarily progressive is going to happen in Canada in the next 4 years.
Do you think the current NDP leadership race is one situation where activists can become more involved and affect real change for the future?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things as well that, I mean, Americans have a much worse menu of options than Canadians do. Not only do you have a genuinely left-wing party in Canada, which is very open and easy to participate in, but you also have an extremely dynamic political system in Canada. I mean, there are many ways in which I think the political system in the United States is almost completely broken, and there's no sign that it's going to get any better. That there's actually a huge crisis of American democracy right now. A Canadian political system, by contrast, is actually quite robust. And one of the things that and healthy. One of the things that I take to be a sign of health is just the fact that there's turnover in the parties. You know, like we've seen that within the lifetime of people not that old, like my lifetime, we've seen like the decline and the rise of completely new political parties. And so it's not obvious that the political system is blocked the way it is in the United States and that there isn't some kind of payoff to participating in, for example, NDP politics.
How would you compare the Tea Party and the Occupy movement in terms of their origin story and how they're trying to affect change?
Well, I think that they... Obviously, they appeal to different constituencies, and they have completely different origin stories. They're in reaction to different things, but there's useful comparisons to be drawn between them. And the Occupy movement, I think, could, you know, I mean, they wish they could be as influential as the Tea Party has been, right? And one of the things that you've seen with the Tea Party is the way in which they've been able to push the Republican Party to the right through a variety of tactics, right? And that's something that the more radical left is always complaining about and aspiring to, complaining about the centrism of political parties and the fact that, you know, the liberals say are not left-wing enough for them. I mean, by global standards, the Liberal Party of Canada is a left-wing political party. It's a center-left party. Right? So, for example, on any major issue, the Liberal Party of Canada is to the left of the UK Labour Party. Right? So from a global perspective, it's a left-wing party. In fact, from a global perspective, Canada has three left-wing parties. The Green Party, NDP, and the BQ, and the Liberal Party of Canada are all center-left parties. Now, if you say that in Canada, people get all upset because they say, oh, my God, you know, the Liberals are totally right-wing. But anyhow, there's a constant complaint on the part of the left that the parties are too centrist and that they don't take sufficiently progressive positions. I think in the United States, you could fairly say that of the Democratic Party. In Canada, it's more difficult to say that. But there has always been this traditional aspiration to push the political parties further to the left. Well, the Tea Party has succeeded in doing that on the right side to the Republican Party. And so if Occupy were to do that to the Democrat Party, that, I think, would be regarded by many people as being incredibly successful.
So do you think in this congressional election coming up, or perhaps in the next one, we could see traditional Democrats fighting Occupy Democrats in primaries?
It would be interesting to see if that would happen. I mean, you know, the American, in many ways, I'm sort of happy to be Canadian. I mean, the American left, it's very frustrating being an American liberal. And, you know, the left is not as powerful a constituency within the Democratic Party, certainly not the radical left. So you have this a case where the Democratic Party in the States takes positions that are to the right of the majority of the population, right? So, for example, on taxes, there's broad-based support for an increase in the progressivity of the taxation system in the States. And yet the Democratic Party, you know, majority-wise, opposes it or is too timid to enact it and so forth. So, I mean, I can understand there's a huge amount of frustration in the States, much of which is produced by the economic conditions in the States, which are much worse than in Canada, but many of which are created by the political system, whereby, you know, it's not entirely true, but there is a lot to be said for the idea that there's two right-wing political parties in the United States. So if the Occupy movement were to be able to actually push the Democratic Party to the left, that would be a significant victory. Whether or not that's going to happen, you know, I'm not an expert on American affairs. But I think, for example, Democratic politicians are intimidated by the right in the United States. They get intimidated by the Tea Party. They get intimidated by the right-wing media. And so to the extent that there's a left-wing protest movement that serves as a countervailing force, I think that could usefully serve to embolden Democratic politicians. So, for example, I think the Occupy movement might reasonably claim some role in having in the delay of the Keystone Pipeline, right? I mean, that was an unusually bold move on the part of Democrats, and I think it's not an accident that that happened at the time when there's mass mobilization and street protest, because partly they don't want to attract that kind of protest, right? Right. So anyhow, it doesn't seem to me inconceivable that the Occupy movement could actually have a huge impact on the Democratic Party, because right for the last 3 years, the left in the United States has just been sitting on their hands while the Tea Party and the Republican Party eats their lunch.
Right. I know I was kind of frustrated myself by the whole supermajority BS and things like that going on when Obama had the House, the Senate, and the executive all with, I guess, under a Democratic flag.
Yeah, and the passage of the healthcare reform bill was being portrayed as anti-majoritarian, as contrary to the will of Americans, because he didn't have a supermajority in the Senate, right? And now you have the Republicans controlling just the lower house. I mean, you know, it's important to keep reminding people the Democrats still have a majority in the Senate, and they're doing all kinds of things that are almost never portrayed as counter-majoritarian, even though Democrats control, you know, with a majority, both the Senate and the presidency. But they're completely blocking the agenda, yet that somehow is not perceived as being contrary to the will of the American majority.
Right.
Right. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, I'm happy not to be American and not to have to worry about a political system which is that broken.
Do you find that there are parts of the Canadian political system that are kind of broken? I mean, we're in an age right now where the Conservatives are stifling debate on bills such as the Wheat Board Bill, the Omnibus Crime Bill, on copyright legislation, and the Conservatives are saying, well, we have a mandate because we have this majority government. Meanwhile, I believe only 39.4% of Canadians who cast a ballot actually cast a ballot for the Conservatives. Do you find that frustrating at all?
The mechanism of plurality rule, whereby the person who gets the most votes wins, doesn't bother me. It's not a reasonable standard to expect people, especially in a three-party system, it's not a reasonable standard to expect everybody to have more than 50%. But that having been said, I mean, there are lots of worrying features of the way in which the Canadian political system is developing that are very sort of intra-Canadian. And so, for example, I mean, you know, we have a British parliamentary system that relies very, very heavily upon traditions. And, you know, the unwritten constitution and so forth. And, you know, over my lifetime, you've seen a steady degradation of a lot of the rules of decorum, which were actually important parts of the proper functioning of Parliament. And the Conservatives, I mean, it's always dangerous. I mean, political parties tend to like rules when they're in opposition, because rules are important at constraining the bad guys who are currently in power. But then once they become, once they acquire power, they say, oh, we're good guys. And so now it's important that we do anything we can to circumvent these rules, because, of course, we're, you know, morally superior to the people who came before us, and therefore we can't do wrong just because our purposes are good, right? And so you have a huge amount of that in the Conservative Party, and therefore you wind up with an extraordinary level of contempt for parliamentary tradition. I mean, this is something that those of us, like me who are old enough to remember the Mulroney years will remember as well, because the Mulroney government also had, in many cases, exhibited a kind of shocking contempt for tradition by, for example, expanding the size of the Senate in order to get bills passed and things like that. I mean, what's to be said about it? It's too bad that we have a conservative party with so little respect for tradition. I think, obviously, the use of closure and debates in Parliament is incredibly noxious. I think the kind of stonewalling you had by Tony Clement, when he was simply refusing over the course of weeks to answer any questions in question period, then makes that institution completely worthless. There's a lot of worrying developments in Parliament. At the same time, I don't think it's inconceivable that you could also, at some point, get the parties together within the Canadian federal political system to agree to some kind of revision of parliamentary procedures. I mean, and partly because there's lots of different models of how you can organize things. Look at the UK, look at New Zealand, look at Australia. There's lots of countries with broadly similar parliamentary systems that have tried out different ways of doing things. And so I don't find that the atmosphere is so poisonous that I can't imagine circumstances in which the existing problems would be fixed, if you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, I see all kinds of worrying developments, but I also don't think that they've gotten to the point where they can't be fixed. Whereas by contrast, if you look at the United States, it's impossible to conceive of how the major problems could ever be fixed anymore within that political system.
Okay, now shifting gears. From what I have read with interviews and stuff, you advocate for ethical consumerism rather than anti-consumerism. Could you go into a little bit what you mean by ethical consumerism?
Well, I mean, ethical consumerism is simply when you make consumption choices based on more than just self-interest, but rather on the implications for other people of your consumption. I have actually a sort of ambivalent attitude towards ethical consumerism, in the sense that in an ideal world, and even in an ideal market economy, you actually wouldn't have to be an ethical consumer, because the price that you pay for goods is supposed to reflect the true social cost of your consumption. And so if prices were actually set at the right levels, then you actually shouldn't have to worry about sort of other people. I mean, it sounds callous to say it, but that is sort of the extent that there's value in a market economy, this is it.
Right.
It's the fact that the prices constitute the point at which everyone else is fully compensated for your consumption. For your consumption.
That really sounds like the argument for fair trade goods.
Well, the fair trade is kind of complicated. The basic idea, though, and the central argument for capitalism is basically just that it gets prices right. And what that means in terms of right is that they reflect actual social cost. And what that means in turn is that resources won't be wasted, because they'll tend to be used only by people who most need them. Now, in therefore an ideal system where you had the right price level, you wouldn't have to engage in ethical consumption. You would be able to rely upon capitalism, as it were, to make sure that everybody gets adequately compensated.
Right.
The problem is that in a whole range of different areas, we have prices that we know are wrong. And this is particularly the case with goods that have environmental externalities. So burning fossil fuel produces greenhouse gases. You don't have to compensate the people who are affected by climate change, for example. And as a result, the price is too low. We know the price of fossil fuel is too low. Now, ideally, what you would do is you would correct that price with a carbon tax. And as a result, your consumption of fossil fuel would reflect its true cost to society. As it is now, you get a bit of a free ride. That's what creates the opening for ethical consumption, right? So you should consume less fossil fuel because it's bad for the environment.
Right.
Now, but it is important to recognize that ethical consumption is something of a stopgap measure, right? It's because of defects in either the market or the system of regulation that there's a need for consumers to be ethical. Ideally, you would change the law so that we're all forced to be ethical, you know, which means in a sense paying the full cost of our activities.
Right. What about people struggling to make ends meet? Who, if we're making ethical choices right now with our dollars? I believe in the Uptown magazine interview, you talked about the choice to purchase a hybrid rather than a non-hybrid vehicle. What about people struggling to make ends meet who can't choose to buy ethically upstanding products?
I think that the other thing that's important is to separate, and this is sort of, it's kind of a subtle point, but it's important to separate questions of inequality and distribution of wealth from the question of the pricing of goods and services. And so there is sometimes a tendency to want to fiddle with prices as a way of addressing distributive justice concerns. So, for example, in Canada, you know, we in almost every jurisdiction, we heavily subsidize electricity. And so it's not just that we don't have, you know, carbon taxes on coal-fired electricity and so forth. It's not just that we don't have green taxes on electricity. We actually pay below market prices for electricity throughout much of the country. Now, whenever you try to raise the price of electricity to reflect something like true social cost, people say, oh, well, what about the poor? What about people who can't afford to heat their houses? You know, so, I mean, the NDP had what I think is this crazy platform or like policy plank in their platform in the last federal election, where they wanted to give people GST exemptions on heating oil. I mean, that's basically subsidizing fossil fuels, right? Like it's the exact opposite of what you should be doing from an environmental perspective. Right? So why would you want to subsidize heating oil? Well, the answer is, well, because of a distributive justice concern, because some people have trouble paying their heating bills, right? You don't want their heat to get cut off. Now, the problem with it, and I think that there's a very powerful and very traditional argument made by economists about this, it's to say that the best, if the problem is that people are getting their heat cut off in the winter, the best way to redress that is by supplementing their income. And we already have a mechanism for doing that, the income tax system. So you can give people earned income tax credits or what have you in order to pay their heating bill. There's, in other words, you just give them money. The problem with lowering the price of heating oil is that it lowers the price of heating oil for everybody in the entire economy, rich and poor alike. And it distorts behavior. It causes people to waste heating oil. So I think that there's sort of two parts to it then with the ethical consumption. I mean, so the ethical consumption is ideally what you would have in a system where prices reflect true social cost. That's in many cases going to wind up raising certain prices, like for energy. So then you say, okay, what about the poor? The way you deal with the poor is by giving them money or by giving them vouchers or what have you, not by fiddling with the prices.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me today.
Yeah, that's my pleasure.
That was philosophy professor and author Joseph Heath speaking with me about anti-consumerism and activism in Canada. Thanks for listening to Needs No Introduction, Fresh Ideas from Speakers of Note. To find more great podcasts, go to rabble.ca/podcasts. I'm Leif Larson. Talk to you soon.